Hello and everyone, welcome to the debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. An affront to justice, that's how the UN has described President Trump's recent pardons for Blackwater mercenaries. Rights experts complain that a pardon for the four security contractors convicted of killing Iraqi civilians in 2007 undermines humanitarian law. UN experts have reminded the fact that based on the Geneva Convention, war criminals must be held accountable for their crimes even when acting as private security contractors. That's the topic of our debate show tonight. Stay with us for that. Now let's go to Washington, D.C. to our own correspondent, Dr. Colin Campbell. Colin, last week we were discussing the same issue from a different angle, and there was media blackout. Majority of mainstream U.S. media didn't mention this. Now the UN has taken it to a different level. It's now some kind of a legal challenge. What about now?
That's right, and it looks like the media has picked up on it a little bit, really expressing outrage from some of the commentators that have remarked about the pardons that the president made for these contractors from Blackwater. As we understand, this was an egregious crime that was committed with the slaughter of innocent Iraqi civilians that were later the perpetrators of this crime, now can walk free. So you have some media outlets, if they aren't just saying and stating what happened as a declarative, they're expressing outrage, anger, and just disbelief that these would be the people that the president has pardoned. Now, what is being looked at also is just the whole pardoning process. I think that the president has put a test on the whole system of who is pardoned and why. Usually it is for people who were not afforded equity in under the eyes of the law. Maybe there was a law that was misapplied, or maybe something that was done unjudiciously, or something that was done a little bit too exacting or too draconian in method. Well, this time it seems that this was the prevalent president's privilege that he took to pardon people that he felt should be pardoned, or some people who were giving deference to the president. And I think that's why there are many people who are now questioning just the whole system of who is pardoned. Again, this is not the main story that is coming from U.S. media, but it is something that is being discussed, especially amongst those who are at liberty to discuss the topics of the day with a little bit more freedom in their rhetoric rather than just stating the news of the day as a flat declarative.
Okay, thank you, Doc. Our own Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. Now, joining me to discuss this a little bit and look at it from different angles, first will be former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desaias, out of Geneva. Good to have you with us, Alfred. Welcome to the show. And, you know, as you know, these security contractors took the lives of Iraqi civilians back in 2007. On what ground has President Trump pardoned them?
Well, we have a culture of impunity in the United States, and this is only one of many cases. Constitutionally, the president does have the authority to pardon criminals, except that in this case, basically, he's giving his blessing on murder, his blessing on a massive war crime. But it's not just the practice of granting pardons. Is also the consistent pattern of impunity for American soldiers to commit crimes and for private security companies whose members, and we had nearly 100,000 private security officials in Iraq at the time, and there were many other major crimes committed. It's not just this one in Nusra Square in 2007. I remember the crimes committed at the time of the rape of Fallujah, and we know the crimes committed in Guantanamo as a daily torture situation that has been repeatedly condemned by United Nations rapporteurs, and all of these persons involved in these crimes have enjoyed and continue enjoying impunity. As an American, I can say not in my name. I mean, I find it egregious, I find it outrageous. But as Campbell just said, the mainstream media doesn't like to carry these stories. I recall when I was a young student at Harvard, that was during the Vietnam War, and there were all of these war crimes committed by American soldiers against the Vietnamese people, civilians, women, and children. Very little made it to the press, and it was us, the activists, the students, who were protesting because we had heard about these things and we wanted to see accountability on the part of American soldiers. Who was tried? This insignificant Lieutenant William Calley, instead of trying General Maxwell Taylor, instead of holding the hires up accountable for the systematic crimes being committed in Vietnam, and for decades now, since the beginning of the so-called War on Terror, we have had a problem of so-called secret prisons, the problem of extraordinary renditions. Mm-hmm. And my colleague and rapporteur on human rights while combating terrorism, Ben Emerson, did a study on extraordinary renditions. And it turned out that 54 countries in the world participated in the extraordinary renditions. And countries like Poland, Romania, Egypt, etc., all participated in this completely illegal program of kidnapping and sending people to be tortured. I mean, we had special agreement with Egypt, and we sent people specifically to be tortured in Egypt. Wow. And of course, we continued the torture in Guantanamo, and as I said, in total impunity, because no one has ever been held accountable.
Okay. Now let me also invite Sina Ellis with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York. Good to have you with us, sir. Ian, rights groups argue that allowing private security firms like Blackwater to operate with impunity in armed conflicts will embolden the states to circumvent their obligations under humanitarian law. Is that true?
Yeah, quite clearly. I was present at the first, the negotiations that led to the signing of the UN, of the International Criminal Court. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to a lot of the State Department and U.S. military analysts and lawyers who were involved. And their sincere thesis was that because the law only allowed for prosecution if the state concerned had failed, then it was okay. Americans were protected because they said, we have the best military justice system in the world. I had memories of Milei, like our other interlocutor there, where you might remember it took something like 30 years for the pilot of the helicopter that stopped the massacre to be recognized by Bill Clinton. But Bill Clinton was the president at the time and was at least paying lip service when the treaty was signed. We know that the U.S. couldn't ratify it because of Republican opposition, and it's on the basic same principle. The U.S. can never do any wrong. I mean, it's American exceptionalism to the max. First of all, the U.S. can do no wrong. And secondly, that anyone wearing a uniform must be supported, which we're seeing with police impunity, with military impunity. He shot somebody in full daylight who was unarmed, but he's a policeman doing his duty, so we must support him. It's that attitude that pervades the whole system. And it really has come out here because these people were, that they were paid security guards. That they were like the doorman in a nightclub. I mean, it's like the bouncer in a nightclub, the option to kill people at will. And internationally, that's how it will be seen. This was a clear massacre. Not the only one, by the way. They haven't even tried to investigate the massacre in the square that WikiLeaks revealed, where a helicopter up in the air gunned down a Reuters camera crew and then gunned down the people who went to rescue them and give them medical aid. That hasn't even been investigated yet, let alone prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a whole level of impunity which needs examination. Of course, we know, in fact, that the people who leaked that, they are being persecuted by the government, but not the people who kept it secret, who did it, who ordered it, who provided the circumstances, empowered those people to go in and kill civilians. And it's bad for the US in every way, not just morally, but if you're going to be cynical, it means that their word is worth nothing when it comes to looking for war criminals abroad. Who would hand over somebody to the United States as a suspected war criminal, knowing the United States' partial record, where that they protect the guilty when it's theirs and persecute the innocent when they're foreigners?
Okay. Now back to Geneva. Alfred, UN rights experts are also warning that pardons and amnesties, I'm quoting them, open doors for future abuses when states use the service of private military and security companies for inherent state functions. Do you share the same opinion?
Well, I've written that in some of my old reports to the Human Rights Council and to the General Assembly. Indeed, in the ontology of the state is to keep an army and to keep discipline in that army. The main problem with private security companies is that it's an attempt to outsource this ontological responsibility of the state. And there the so-called status of forces abroad agreements that essentially grant them total immunity in the countries where they're operating, in this case Iraq, on the assumption that if they commit a crime that they will be under in personam jurisdiction of United States courts, and that the military will actually investigate those allegations of war crimes, and that those responsible will be brought to justice. Well, here we have four individuals from Blackwater who were, in fact, brought to court and convicted back in 2014 for murder. It is a disgrace for a country under the rule of law that it would be tolerated that a crime as egregious as this one would be subject to pardoning. But as Mr. Trump said, these were people who had a long history of service to our nation, and therefore they deserve being pardoned. Now, this is like a mafia boss saying, well, they're my boys. You know, my boys are good boys. And that, when I was a young student in high school in Chicago, I mean, I remember the kind of daily indoctrination, if you want, you know, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What does that mean? Is that we are indoctrinated in believing that we, Americans, are, by definition, the good guys. We're always the good guys. Our soldiers do not commit war crimes. Our private military security officers do not commit war crimes. Only the other side commits war crimes. And that's why what we need is universal jurisdiction.
Right.
So that countries other than the United States, when an American official goes to, say, Switzerland, that if he is, say, the Minister of Defense, and he comes to Switzerland, well, he has responsibility for all the war crimes that have been committed under his jurisdiction,
right,
if he has not ensured accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So universal jurisdiction is a concept that has to be played in.
Right. Now, Ian, in a statement announcing this controversial pardons just a few days ago, the White House said that the move was broadly supported by the public and also backed by a number of Republican lawmakers. Is that really the case?
Well, of fairly sure it was backed by a large number of Republican lawmakers, because they're looking over their shoulders at the Trump supporters who will or won't vote for them. I mean, you know, if Adolf Hitler had the good sense to wear a GI's uniform, these people would all be supporting him, no problem. But on the other side, when we're talking about the public, is the public aware of it? That's the real problem. And I think my colleague here was making the point, the public is not aware of most of this stuff. Mm-hmm. If you ask them about Milei, it's not on their list of battles. If you ask them about Abu Ghraib, if you ask them about Guantanamo, this is not big on the mental horizon. It's an issue that's buried very thoroughly. If it's brought up at all by the media, it's very likely, because the media has exactly the same prejudices. Our guys are right, the other side are wrong. If our guys are wrong now and again, then we should cut them some slack, because they're doing this for us after all. I mean, there is a cult of the uniform and the veteran here in the United States, which pervades everything. A veteran, I mean, you know, a veteran can do no wrong. In fact, lots of veterans do wrong. And, you know, the whole point of people in uniform is you're training them to go abroad and kill people. Mm-hmm. And they often do it, excessively, with too much zeal. And so people do feel sympathy for them. You know, I've spoken, everyone calls the Second World War the finest war. I've spoken to many veterans who tell horrifying stories about what happened to prisoners who fell into their hands if they were inconvenient. And, but they're just ignored. People know about them, but the reality is obscured to preserve this overall vision that the United States is a city on the hill. It's not just the United States, of course. Lots of other countries. The British have never held responsible those who committed atrocities in Kenya or in South Yemen or in India, come to think of it, the other places where they're involved. The French have never come to terms with Algeria. So, you know, it's not a uniquely American problem,
right.
But it is, because America is, the United States is the sort of founding partner of the United Nations, keeps saying it's taking action to uphold international law. Its actions against Iran are wreathed in the obligations to under international law and order, and yet it completely flouts it whenever it suits them. And in this particular case, there were options. I mean, Donald Trump could have said, oh, well, look, these guys, they were young, they're in a terrible situation, so I'll exercise clemency. We'll commute their sentences. But he didn't. He said a pardon. And the pardon implies this is all right, that they are, in effect, judicially speaking, innocent.
Yeah, but I wonder if Trump knows the difference between pardon and clemency. Now,
well, it's a tough call, I agree.
All right. Alfred, you both talked about, Ian talked about global jurisdiction. The ICC, ICJ, I mean, the U.S. does not recognize, you know, these international tribunals. So we have had a long record of the U.S. doing things, similar things since the Korea War, the things that the U.S. did in Afghanistan, you know, the UN probe about it and all that. So is there a remedy to this? Exceptionalism, U.S. forces always being good guys, infallible, great, you know, guys who never do anything wrong?
Well, it's up to us Americans to make sure that our fellow Americans, shall we say, grow up and realize that exceptionalism is not the way forward. But we still live in this bubble, and we still believe that we are the good guys. And it took me decades, actually, to separate myself from that, to say jump over my own shadow, to think outside the box. Not everybody does that. Here you are in your comfort zone. But while we're talking about universal jurisdiction, I mean, this can be done, and actually it has occurred. Back years ago, 2007 or 2008, when Donald Rumsfeld went to a right-wing group to speak in Paris, he had to escape because there was a warrant for his arrest. And he left Paris and he went into Germany and was flown back to the United States with a military plane. So you see that there is a possibility under international law to prosecute for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and under the Convention Against Torture, which the United States has ratified.
Right.
Under the Convention Against Torture, there is an obligation of the territorial states to arrest and try whatever person is within its jurisdiction, in its territory, like Donald Rumsfeld at that moment,
right,
who is accused of having committed torture. That is, not he personally, but he as the responsible minister whose soldiers committed torture in Guantanamo and elsewhere. Let me just say one point.
Okay, we have only a few seconds left.
Assange and Snowden, we demand absolutely, and we must demand as Americans, mm-hmm, that the president grant pardon both to Julian Assange and to Edward Snowden, both of whom are human rights defenders.
Okay.
And they have done more for the world than many others, and I think that the campaign against Assange is disgraceful. My colleague Niels Meltzer, rapporteur on torture, has specifically written to Donald Trump and demanded a pardon for...
Okay, Alfred, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. We're out of time. Thank you very much for your comments. We had senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York, and former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desaias, out of Geneva. And your host, Fahruz Najafi.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Last night we talked about a very important dimension of balance that must exist in every person and in our community. And that is the balance that we should strike between being emotional and being rational. We need to have both, and if we lose one of them or if we overdo one of them, then it creates problems. I mentioned two hadith about the significance of having a kind of emotional unity or connection or link with Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And now I'm going to share with you the third hadith, which leads us to another characteristic of the community, and that is truthfulness. Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi as-salam, in a famous hadith, said, إن الله تبارك وتعالى أطلع إلى الأرض فاختارنا واختار لنا شيعة. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looked at the earth, looked at the people, and among them He chose us. And He chose for us some Shia, some followers. ينصروننا. These are the people that help us. These are the people that achieving our goals. Then Amir al-Mu'mineen said, "Man adha'a sirrana, adhaqahu Allahu ba'sa al-hadid." If someone discloses our secrets, Allah will make him taste the pain of iron. It means that he's going to see the attacks of the enemies, the swords and bombs and killings coming from enemies, prison, torture, because he was not careful about keeping the secrets. Okay, now because Amir al-Mu'mineen mentioned the point about truthfulness, I move to the other characteristic of the community of Ahlul Bayt, which I promised in the first night that inshallah we are going to expand on that. The community of Ahlul Bayt has to be truthful. We have to be honest in our speech, in our behavior. I cannot, you know, when I'm going and proposing marriage, you know, look very nice, you know, kind. And then when I get the marriage done, then I show my real face. Before marriage, I don't say anything about my bad habits. And after marriage, I say everything. This is not a Shia. A Shia has to be honest in words, in a speech, even in intention. Sidqun niyyah is very important. Everything must be done for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not for the sake of pleasing people or showing off or, you know, making people, you know, praise me, appreciate me, thank me. Hadith says that you are not a mu'min unless whether people blame you or praise you would be the same for you. If you know what is being done is true and correct and right, then people thank me or don't thank me. It's not important for me. Yes, in the process of finding what I have to do, it's important to consult people, consult mu'mineen, consult educated people. But when you are 100% sure, you have done all the checking and you know that this is what Allah wants from you, then people don't appreciate or people appreciate, it's not going to make any difference. لا يخافون في الله لومة لائم. Even people, if blame you, you shouldn't have any worry. Make sure you do what is right, then you should have no worry. So, Sidq has different levels. It starts with a speech, goes to actions, then goes to intention.
Call of Islam Radio presents The Spiritual Message of Islam.
Sometimes for many years you don't realize what problems are there in your heart.
Piety and its indicators.
So taqwa is considered to be the goal of fasting.
Wisdom.
What does wisdom mean and how can we equip ourselves with wisdom?
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers, open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true. Tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Let me read for you some hadith, and inshallah we can continue tomorrow. There are many hadith in Usul al-Kafi about the significance of Sidq. And all the hadith I'm quoting are from Usul al-Kafi. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, إِنَّ اللَّهَ عَزَّ وَجَلْ لَمْ يَبْعَثْ نَبِيًّا. Allah has not sent any prophet إِلَّا, unless that Allah has asked that prophet to observe and preach three values. Of course, it doesn't mean that there were not four and five. I mean, these three were included. All the prophets. This is a universal teaching of all the prophets. بِصِدْقِ الْحَدِيثِ. All the prophets have asked people to be truthful in their speech. وَأَدَاءِ الْأَمَانَ. And to deliver the trust. إِلَى الْبَرِّ وَالْفَاجِرِ. Deliver the trust to the good people and to the bad people. So you can count it as two or one. So it doesn't make difference. Even if a very bad person gives something to you and says, you know, please keep this for me, you have to keep it. Imam Zainul Abidin said, even if the killer of my father gives as trust, as amana to me, the sword by which he killed my father, I will give him back. I will keep for him and give him back. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, who was known to be Amin and honest, even after 13 years of fighting against him, Kuffar still used to leave their valuable things with him. The pagans of Mecca entrusted the valuable things with him, even after 13 years. When Rasulullah wanted to go to Medina, he had some of the amanat of these people of Mecca with him. He didn't say, you know, they have killed us, they have tortured us, we are running away from them, let's take this, you know, and make, you know, something for the community. He said to Amirul Mu'mineen, give these trust and amanat back to the owners and then join me. This is amana. So if there is a survey in any town in which we have Shia community, who is the most trustworthy in this town? If the survey shows that the Shia are the most trustworthy ones, we are Shia. Otherwise, we are not Shia. We have to be most trustworthy. Of course, at the same time, we have to make sure that we register loans. You know, Islam says you register everything, you do it properly. But these are just for formalities. When you give me something, even without any witness, without any writing, any paper, you have to be 100% sure that I may give my life, but I will not betray. This is the level of trust that we must establish among ourselves and extend it to other people, whether they are good people or bad people. Imagine if this quality is achieved, how much people would love us and respect us, and also for those who are interested in business, how much business would come to this community if they know that you are so much trustworthy.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe as hard, and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues to surge across the world, many countries have started mass vaccinations in an effort to bring the virus under control. From Europe to Latin America, many nations have imported vaccines in large quantities to help their people get rid of the highly infectious disease. Iran, however, has managed to come up with its own domestically produced COVID-19 vaccine. The country has now begun testing the inoculation on humans after successfully completing the initial steps, including tests on animals and obtaining necessary approvals. The human trial of the vaccine was initiated at the headquarters of executing the order of Imam Khomeini in the capital Tehran on Tuesday. A total of 56 volunteers will gradually receive injections during the first stage. The vaccine, Coviran Barakat, is named after the pharmaceutical group behind its development. The achievement comes as Iranian authorities have been critical of the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy a vaccine from abroad. Many believe the Iranian-made vaccine proves the country's enhanced capabilities despite U.S. sanctions.
Necessity is the mother of invention, they say, and the Iranian people needed a vaccine. The U.S. Maximum pressure campaign denied them access to the vaccines, and so the Iranian people, their scientists, their government, had to go the extra mile to be resilient and develop their own domestic vaccine. It's a remarkable achievement, but it's the kind of thing that is an unintended consequence of campaigns of maximum pressure and hybrid warfare against countries. People learn to be self-sufficient, to be reliant, and they make new alliances with other countries in the military, economic, and political spheres, and that's exactly what Iran has done.
On Saturday, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani once again lashed out at Washington, saying its wicked activities have caused trouble for Tehran to acquire vaccines. Earlier this month, the head of Iran's central bank also slammed the U.S. administration for its sanctions, which he said have been hampering efforts to purchase the inoculation. Abdel Nasser Hemmati said Iran is prepared to purchase the vaccine through the World Health Organization, but it is unable to transfer the required money due to what he called inhumane U.S. sanctions. Hemmati, however, expressed hope that the vaccine-related transactions will be facilitated through other channels. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal in May 2018. Since then, American officials have targeted every Iranian sector with sanctions ever enforced against any nation. The U.S. economic pressure has prompted the Iranian officials to take a tactical step against such measures. Earlier this month, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, urged officials to focus on neutralizing the sanctions apart from securing their removal. The leader even cautioned against trusting the enemies and warned that U.S. hostilities toward Iran will not end once President Trump leaves office. But from the medical field to the military complex, technology, and a whole host of other fields, Iran has advanced its know-how domestically thanks to the U.S. maximum pressure campaign and sanctions.
Clearly, the U.S. campaign of maximum pressure has not succeeded in overturning the government of the Islamic Republic, and in fact has made it stronger and more resilient. And an unintended consequence of all of this maximum pressure campaign has been to force Iran and other countries under the thumb of the U.S. to become more self-reliant and to seek other trading arrangements, other military arrangements, other political alliances. And the end result is that the U.S. empire is now declining, and it will continue to decline at an ever-accelerating pace.
But the U.S. measures are not bound to sanctions alone. Washington and its allies, namely Israel, have a long history of using other evil tactics to prevent Tehran from its advancements. That includes the assassination of Iranian scientists, with Mohsen Fakhrizadeh being the latest victim of U.S. and Israeli plots. Fakhrizadeh is not the only Iranian scientist assassinated by the American and Israeli agents, and probably will not be the last one.
The U.S. and many of the G20 countries engage in regimes of economic sanctions and programs of hybrid warfare against a number of countries with the point of bringing these countries under their control. The U.S. is an empire, and it uses campaigns of hybrid warfare, which included, for example, the targeted assassinations of General Soleimani and the nuclear scientist Dr. Fakhrizadeh. Includes economic sanctions. It includes continuing attacks in the mainstream media. It includes lawfare initiatives against the government of Iran. And it does all this in the hope of bringing down the Iranian government.
Probably they forget the fact that the advancement of a nation does not depend on one person. Eliminating icons like Fakhrizadeh will, of course, be felt for long, but will not stop Iran from going forward. The U.S. anti-Iran moves also raise questions as who is the United States really targeting by using all possible means to block a country's progress, be it hampering efforts to buy a coronavirus vaccine or anything else.
From the very start, there was no doubt that the EU would not give the British a deal that would match any of the conditions met by being a member of the EU. So when Johnson and von der Leyen announced a deal had been struck, why then did the UK hail it as a victory? But with the details yet to be fully made public, many people are labelling the deal as a sham for the British, clearly suggesting that the EU negotiators, led by Michel Barnier, stood firm to the end and made sure that the EU did not come out the loser on the deal. According to one French source familiar with the exact details of the paper and who wished to remain anonymous, it seems that the British made huge concessions, giving up many of the terms and conditions they claimed that they would fight for. However, it seems that ultimately the British team had no choice but to cave in. Several days after the deal was announced, EU and British officials and lawmakers are poring over the details. The document is rumoured to be some 1,200 pages long, but once read and digested, will demonstrate just how many concessions the UK finally gave into and revealed just exactly what Boris Johnson tried to hide on announcement day.
Brexit is a disaster, an absolute disaster, and it's one that Boris Johnson is like hugely responsible for just by himself. I mean, as a journalist, he did his very best to poison the waters between the UK and the EU. He succeeded, the referendum passed, and now Britain is facing the reality, just a few days away, of a forcible separation from the continent.
What was clear from Johnson's announcement is that nothing new has come from the deal, with Britain claiming victory over its borders, freedom of movement and trade criteria, all things that, with a deal or not, Britain would have had anyway. So where then does the victory lie for Whitehall? Johnson's next task is to win over the hardline Brexiteers, many of whom wanted to leave the EU without a deal, claiming that Britain will be fine on its own. However, it seems that Johnson may have already convinced many to fall in line, as any sign of division now by the British would send a message to the world that the deal was in fact a disaster for the UK, a message that Britain can ill afford to leak out. The British made numerous promises prior to the announcement of the deal between Britain and the EU. Some of these promises included protecting the rights of British fishermen, farmers and businesses. Yet it seems, as details slowly emerge, not all are happy about the deal. British fishermen, for one, have already started claiming that they've been sold out by Boris Johnson as they face sharing British waters with EU fishermen for the next 5.5 years, only increasing their quota from 10% to 20%, suggesting that not much will change. But when it comes to the financial value of fishing in the UK, one has to really question the fishing industry culture. With fishing making up only 0.1% of the overall British GDP, is it any wonder then that Johnson failed to push hard for a fair deal, raising the question as to just what else he folded on?
There are several. There are the question of fishing rights, which apparently he had to give more ground than he wanted to. Which essentially gives the EU greater rights in the English Channel than British fishermen had wanted to grasp. The other one involves business services, and that's really quite unclear as to what will happen. The agreement is 1,200 pages long, so no one at this point is quite sure what's in it.
For Johnson, and all in favour of Brexit, a long road lies ahead before the full impact of Brexit becomes clear. But what's for sure is the level of uncertainty and division that lies ahead. For a start, Scotland will no doubt seek a second independence referendum, sparking a chain reaction that will likely see the north of Ireland request to be united with the Republic of Ireland, causing a breakup of the UK, something that seems an inevitable consequence of Brexit. From the EU perspective, Britain, it seems, is a spent force, a country living in the fading memories of past glory, and slowly but surely floating further away from Europe, something that the EU, for one, we'll be happy to watch sinking on the horizon.
The United Arab Emirates has become a trade hub in the region, with strong links across West and South Asia and Europe. The country has, among other things, been trying to establish itself as a large and fast-growing marketplace for gold. According to data collected by the Observatory for Economic Complexity, the UAE's gold imports have increased by an average of 58% to over $27 billion in 2018. The Arab country's fondness for gold comes amid its plummeting oil reserves and the UAE's drive to diversify its economy. Gold has proven to be a lucrative commodity in the past months, particularly as investors favored the precious metal as a safe haven during the uncertainties in other markets as the coronavirus pandemic hit. The importance of gold for Dubai's economy is such that its trade volume surpassed that of diamonds, oil, jewelry, and cell phones in 2019.
The United Arab Emirates has no gold on its own, as is clear. They have oil, but they have no gold yet. Gold is their second largest export. So all of their 17.7 billion of their gold export is being imported first and washed or laundered by re-exporting it mainly through the UK into Switzerland and other gold refining places like India.
But there's another side to this story. The United Kingdom's Home Office and Treasury issued a report on money laundering and terrorist financing, labeling the UAE as vulnerable to illicit activities due to a lax policing of gold movements across the country. But how does the UAE acquire all that gold? And where does the country buy the exorbitant amount of precious metal from? According to investigations conducted by The Sentry, an NGO that tracks dirty money linked to African war criminals, 95% of gold officially exported from Central and East Africa, much of it mined in Sudan, South Sudan, the Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, ends up in the Emirates. Gold has funded armed conflicts in the region for years, but the jump in prices in the past few months has turned the metal into new blood diamonds, as it's been increasingly obtained through brutal mining practices and illicit profits, including the use of underage workers.
First, the international gold laundering is a gigantic human rights abuse, foremost because it uses many countries in Africa, in South America, are using massive child labor. Children not only are put in tremendous risks working in the mines, in narrow, rickety underground tunnels that could collapse anytime, and often do. But they are also poisoned on a daily basis by chemicals used in extracting gold from the rock.
In 2016, the UAE declared gold imports from 25 African countries worth $7.4 billion, which had not declared any exports to the UAE. The Emirates declared $3.9 billion more in gold from most of the 21 other countries it imported from than was declared in exports.
Gold laundering is an international crime because it is mostly run by mafia-type organizations, where killing and other type of violence, plus sexual abuse of women, forced prostitution, are a daily occurrence. It's actually the law of the day, you could almost say, in these illegal gold mining areas. There should be an international law enforceable, issued by the UN, if at all possible, and enforced. It must be enforced by the International Criminal Court against anything to do with gold laundering.
Gold's small size and high price make it a suitable target for smuggling, and the UAE's minimal control and regulations have turned the country into a magnet for the metal. The situation has become so dire that the London Bullion Markets Association called on Dubai and other gold hubs to conform to the regulatory standards or face a blacklisting of their exports. While the UAE has promised more transparency, only time will tell how and to what extent the country will fulfill its pledge.
The U.S. is facing another crisis thanks to the actions of the U.S. President Donald Trump. This time, it has to deal with a massive COVID-19 relief bill. Donald Trump said that he is unhappy with the massive bill, which provides $892 billion in coronavirus relief, including extending special unemployment benefits. $1.4 trillion is also needed for normal government spending. The U.S. president said that he is not signing it, in part because that one-off $600 stimulus checks for struggling Americans are not large enough.
I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000, or $4,000 for a couple.
An increase to the size of the checks was something Democrats attempted to get, but Republicans refused to accept it, throwing it further into doubt the future of any imminent financial relief for millions of struggling Americans. However, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi plans to hold a vote to approve the $2,000 checks on Monday. Another objection made by Trump was that the bill gives too much money to special interests, cultural projects, and foreign aid.
$600 for the past several months that Americans haven't received any assistance is almost nothing. It's $1.75 a day. It's quite pathetic, especially when you look at how the rest of the bill gives millions of dollars. It gives $33 million to Juan Guaido. It gives millions of dollars to Israel to regime change measures. And this $600 essentially is going to go to landlords. It's going to go to banks. Americans are going to see that money, and it will be gone in the next moment.
Trump's refusal to sign the bill is not just affecting jobless benefits. A partial government shutdown will begin on Tuesday, unless Congress can agree a stopgap government funding bill before then. The U.S. president's move surprised many, particularly since Trump left nearly all of the negotiations to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who made no push for the $2,000 stimulus checks that the U.S. president is now seeking. All through the months-long wrangling between Democrats and Republicans over the stimulus package, Trump did not say anything. He didn't object to the terms of the deal before Congress voted it through on Monday. But since then, Trump has constantly complained about it. If he continues to refuse to sign the bill, more than 14 million laid-off Americans could lose their unemployment benefits for weeks. Even if Trump finally agrees to sign it, they would likely suffer a break in payments. States cannot pay out benefits for weeks that begin before the bill is signed. Now, as a result of Trump's refusal to sign the bill, benefits will not restart until the first week of January, but they will still end in mid-March, effectively trimming the extension to 10 weeks from 11. Moreover, a series of additional relief provisions, including an eviction moratorium, are set to expire at the end of the month. Other temporary relief protections shielding millions of Americans from the brunt of the pandemic's economic toll will lapse shortly after the new year without action. Top officials, including Pelosi and Mnuchin, are now privately discussing plans such as a stopgap spending bill in case Trump formally vetoes the measures by Monday. But it is not clear how long that stopgap measure would last or whether Trump would sign it if it makes none of the changes that he wanted. Trump never said that he would veto the legislation anyway. However, he may not have to. The legislation passed with the support of, well, more than two-thirds of both the House and the Senate, easily surpassing the threshold required to override a veto if he actually did that.
It appears to be a partisan divide. Now Trump is saying he won't sign the stimulus package because it's too low. But we also have to look at the fact that when this bill was signed, it was signed with a supermajority in both houses, in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And we got to also remember that the Democrats now have the majority in the House of Representatives. So because they had two-thirds in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, it really doesn't matter if Trump refuses to sign it or not. Of course, the Congress would hope that Trump signs it and that they can get it done, but they could still veto his veto.
But in this scenario, timing means everything. The legislation can become law 10 days after the bill is enrolled, even without a presidential signature. But because the time frame overlaps with the end of the current Congress in January the 3rd and the convening of the 117th Congress,